This is Phil Farron, and I am driving home. It's Thursday today. It's been a good week. We have got a lot of things done this week that we needed to get done. Not quite everything that we wanted to get done, but close enough. So it's looking good for our rollout that's coming up in a couple of weeks. I had hoped to have everything stabilized. Got a little clog in my throat, working my way through that. Sorry. And I didn't even bring any water here. I had initially told everybody at the latest I wanted to have the site landed on the 15th so it could just breathe for a week. Looks like we're going to have the site landed 2 weeks ahead of time, which is good. We can breathe for a couple of weeks. People can get in touch with us, let us know if there's a problem. Plus, we can do a little groundwork with some of the users to show them some of the new functionality. So that's all. That is all puttering along, and it's good. It's good. It's good. Anyways, so hold it. Someone's pulling in front of me now, and we had some. We were doing new things this week that we haven't done before, and I really can't go into details about them, but suffice it to say, they are working. Yay, they're working. Wow, three policemen all around a car outside a pizza joint. Something's going on there. It's coming down. It's going down. It's getting freaky. It's something I don't know. Anyways, had some nice conversations with friends this week, I think. Trying to remember, I think I did. Maybe. I do know one thing that happened this week, which was good. I think it was this week. I'm pretty sure it was this week. For this series, this Windfall series, with its 24 books in this series, you always have to know how you're going to end. I always want to know what's the last scene in the book when I'm doing a series, because sometimes you get started and you don't know where you're landing. And when you don't know where you're going to land, you rarely land well. So doesn't matter that I don't know what's going on between here and the end, which I kind of do. Oh, sorry. I kind of do. I know the general arc. I want to know for sure, specifically, what's going to happen at the end. And it's an epilogue, so I like to get people a little emotional, you know, during the epilogues, if I can. So, I knew what the epilogue was going to be, but I didn't know exactly how the epilogue was going to open. And I think I've got that this week. And it's good. It's good. It ties together a lot of things that are those big questions of things like, why is the universe so enormous? Why does it exist on a scale that is so far beyond what we can conceptualize? And it just sort of puts a topping all on that and provides one possible reason for all that. And so it's good. Now I just have to keep it a secret. Well, have to keep my version of it a secret. It's, I'm sure, has occurred to other people already. I have to keep my version a secret for the next 16 or 17 years. Because I haven't told anybody about it yet. I've been tempted. I've been tempted. But I'm like, no, I get to keep this secret. I may tell my kids that I know it just so they know that I know it at this point. But I'm going to keep this one a secret. So it's good. When I figured that out, I was like, yay. That's going to be good. Anyways, so this week, sorry, I wasn't really sure what I was going to do for the podcast. I've made record of several different things. But then yesterday, I was going home, and there was this, it was interesting because I started listening to it, and I thought, well, okay, I'm not really sure. It had a good title, was The Surprisingly Logical Mind of Babies. Okay, well, that's pretty interesting. So I started listening to the talk, and I just got a little ways into it, and I just was gonna say, okay, never mind. And in fact, I think I did wander off. I think I did wander off and watched another little shorter podcast first. And then after I did that, had a little more time left over, and I thought, well, I'll give it a few more minutes. And then the talk got good. It got good and fascinating. So I thought, oh, I have to talk about this. So this lady's name is Laura Schultz, and she does experiments with babies, trying to figure out what's really happening in their brains. Some really fascinating stuff. She started off her talk with a quote from Mark Twain, which was a fun quote. And it is, there's something fascinating about science. One gets such wholesale returns of conjecture out of such a trifling investment in fact. And she said, in fact, that is how science works. She said, we take samplings, and from that we develop theories, and then we test them some more. And certainly in science, you do not collect all of the available evidence to prove. You simply amass a lot of things that sort of look like it's pointed in the right direction and the same direction, and then you say, ta-da, this must be true. But of course, at any time, that rule that you have developed stands the chance of being knocked off kilter simply because a piece of evidence comes along that disproves it. Which, I know they have an answer for it, but the militant atheist, it still amuses me that they are so adamant that there is no God, since, you know, they have some things that they have interpreted to mean there is no God, which there's really not any definitive thing that they can point to, except the way they point to it in their mind and delineate it by the rules and regulations that they create in their own mind about how God should act, which in its which in itself is a bit of amusing behavior when you decide how God is supposed to act, when you decide that you have enough information as a human being living in this puny little planet, slung off at the unfashionable west end of the Milky Way galaxy, as Douglas Adams says. You know, that is part of the process of science, is to take these less than exhaustive chunks of data and formulate a theory about them. And in fact, that's what this lady designs experiments to do, to see if babies, by babies, we are talking about 16-month-old babies. Toddlers. To see if their brains are in fact examining the world and running inferences about the world. This is fascinating. So this is how they do it. She presented two experiments that they did. Both of them were very, very interesting. What they do is they bring in mom and the baby, put the baby in the high chair, and then they have a presenter or two presenters. So they construct a cloth-covered box that has what looks like a clear mesh panel or a transparent panel on the front. And they place within this box a collection of things. In fact, they also have a hidden... they have a hidden compartment in the back to where they can control what's being chosen from the box. So in the first experiment, they put blue balls and yellow balls on sticks. They have sticks so that you can use them to drum with, or you can use the stick to put the ball down in the hole in that's in the tray in front of them. You know, you can do different things with this yellow stick with a ball on it. And in the first experiment, what they have is they have a few of these yellow sticks with balls on them. But it looks like the rest of the box is filled with blue balls. What the presenter does then, as the baby is watching, the presenter reaches down into the secret compartment, but it looks like she's reaching down into the box. She pulls out a blue ball, and she says, "Oh, look. Look what I have, and look what it does." And she squeezes the blue ball, and there's a squeak toy in it. And of course, the lady who was presenting had a really cute line after that. She said, "You know, for babies, that's as good as a TED Talk." And in fact, they show the footage of them squeaking this toy and the baby's eyes just lighting up, you know. So she does that, and then she reaches down into the box again, it looks like, when in fact she's reaching down into her secret compartment, pulls out another blue ball. Squeak, squeak, squeak. Does it the third time. Squeak, squeak, squeak. All right. So what she has just established is that things that are in the box might have squeakers in them. She then picks out of the box one of the yellow balls with a stick on it, and she hands it to the baby. She puts it down in front of the baby. And then they watch to see what the baby is going to do. Okay, so if the baby is drawing inferences about things that are in this box, the baby might conclude that things that are in that box have a squeaker in them. And in fact, the baby reaches out and grabs the yellow ball on the end of the stick and squeezes it, and then looks very disappointed when it doesn't make any noise. Now, okay, so that's an inference. The baby's making an inference. Sure. Whatever. Now, though, they do something interesting. And in that case, I should mention, in that case, 80% of the babies, I'm looking for the figure, 80% of the babies, 16 months old, tried to squeeze the yellow ball when there was a preponderance of blue balls that they could see through the transparent panel. Now then, they did that experiment. Then they altered it a little bit and they did another experiment. Instead of having the box look like it was filled with a majority of blue balls, they put a mixture in there of blue balls and yellow balls. And in fact, more yellow balls on sticks than blue balls. They did the same thing again. Pull out three blue balls in a row. Squeak, 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 squeak. Then pull out a yellow ball with a stick on it. Put it in front of the babies. This is where it gets very interesting. Because with that slight change, only 30% of the babies tried to squeeze the yellow ball on the end of the stick. So that activity went from 80% to 30%, and the only change was that instead of there being a preponderance of blue balls in the box from what the baby could surmise and could see, there was a higher level of yellow balls on sticks. Now, how the researcher explained this, and I think she's absolutely right, she said, because we can do this experiment over and over, and she said, it works, is apparently the baby, this is where it gets amazing to me, the baby is looking through that transparent panel and is forming assumptions about that box and how people react with it, interact with it. The baby is looking at the preponderance of blue balls and saying, oh, well, it seems likely that the presenter could pick three blue balls in a row because there's a whole bunch of blue balls in that box. And since it's likely that the presenter pulled the balls out randomly and all three of them squeaked, it then seems likely that anything that comes out of the box will squeak. However, if the baby looks and sees that there aren't that many blue balls in the box, but the presenter pulls out three blue balls in a row and they all squeak, the baby loses confidence that the presenter is acting in a random manner. And therefore, the chances that the yellow ball is going to squeak are greatly diminished. 16 months old. And apparently, babies' brains are making that kind of assumption. That's pretty amazing. They are figuring out their world. They're determining what's random, what's contrived, and they are adjusting their behavior on the basis of it. That's pretty amazing. Now then, they did another experiment. Oh, and she said, we had a follow-on to this. And she said, what if we just pull out one ball and squeak it? What would the babies do in that case? Their hypothesis was that given only a sampling of one, it would be far more likely that the baby would reach the assumption that everything in the box squeaked. Because the sampling was only one, and since the sampling was only one, and that sample squeaked, chances were other things squeaked in the box. And in fact, they did that experiment too. They pulled out one blue ball, and they had it squeak. And over 80% of the babies, when handed the yellow ball on a stick, tried to squeeze it and make it squeak. They did another experiment that showed how babies can track the experience of others and then adjust their behavior accordingly. They had what looked like a little hand drum, and it had a button on it. And they had it rigged so they can control when the button would work and when it wouldn't work. Just a second. I've been leaving out my garbage can just out in the road here for years. For years, for months, and it would probably be better if I just tucked it around so people didn't have to look at it. I'll be right back. Okay. So the next experiment was they had this little, like, hand drum that had this button on it. And you'd push it and it would make funny sounds. So the first thing they did was they had two presenters. And they would have, They would have one presenter. Every time that presenter pushed the button, it would work. But every time the other presenter would push the button, it wouldn't work. And so that was demonstrating that the problem with whether or not the button worked was a problem with the person who was operating the toy. So let me just see real quick, because I can't remember exactly. Toy's not working. Either he's doing something wrong or the toy's broken. First pass. Second tails for both. Ah, okay. So, in the first pass, the presenter number one pushes the button on the toy, and it works every time. And it doesn't work for presenter number two. From that, you could infer that presenter number two was the problem. In the second pass, the toy fails to work sporadically. So presenter number one tries it, it works, tries it again, it doesn't work. Presenter number two tries it, it works, tries it again, it doesn't work. Back into my garage. And then what they do is they hand that toy to the baby, and mom is sitting right next to the baby, and then they put another toy on a piece of cloth that the baby can pull to drag the other toy towards them. So it's a question of, do you judge the person problematic because they couldn't make the toy work, or do you judge the toy defective? And what's interesting is in the first pass, when the baby pushes the button and it doesn't work, the majority of the babies would then turn and hand the toy to mom, because maybe another agent could make it work, because obviously I'm doing something wrong. But in the second pass, where the baby sees that it is failing for both people, it just sets the toy aside and grabs the piece of cloth and drags the new toy to herself or himself. So simply from observing how the toy behaves in the hands of the presenters, the baby either infers that there's something wrong with the person operating the toy, or there's something wrong with the toy itself, and changes its behavior, her or his behavior accordingly, which is a pretty sophisticated analysis. I mean, it's just interesting. She did make a couple of statements at the end, too, that I thought were really good. She said, you know, all this talk about how quirky and buggy we are in our mental processes and how we get things wrong in the world so often. She said that's sort of been a meme that's been pushed a lot recently. And she said the fact of the matter is we're ignoring all the stuff we get right. She said we, and she just started rattling off all this stuff that we do with pattern recognition and inferences. And she said we do a lot of stuff that we get right that we just think it's obvious and ignore, when in fact we're doing some really sophisticated samplings and testings and reaching conclusions. And she even made the statement that she did not expect, from basis of, on her research, what she has learned about the brain, how it works, that she really does not expect artificial intelligence to be able to do what a human brain does anytime soon. She said, not in my lifetime, and probably not in my children's lifetime. Which is interesting, because everybody's like predicting, you know, 2050. But her point was, it's not quantity. You just don't need more processors and more speed. She said, what we're doing is something quite different. And she said, it will remain a real challenge for artificial intelligence to actually do what we do. So that's interesting. It's going to be interesting to see how it works out. And as I keep saying, this next 20 years, this next 20 years is going to be fascinating. And who knows, I may still be doing this podcast in 20 years, if for nothing else than just to hear the sound of my own voice. This is Phil Farron, and I have made it home.